On the current, when you said you did it in the last couple of weeks.
Actually, it's a couple months.
Couple months, okay.
But
since June 30th.
Yes.
What was the June 30th number? Relative to the 836. Relative to the 836.
Last, the June 30th, we made 23%.
So the 836 relates to the 23%? If you were to put it on this sheet, if you had done this number on June 30th, what would the 836 have been? I think
probably
I
still been 836. These are projections, what they think is going to happen for the next 10 years.
So what I'm trying to get a sense of is, since you responded that you weren't going to change your allocation at 8.5 or 8, I'm trying to get the sense of what, if we went into a double dip through the end of this year, through January, through next June, how far could the 836 go, roughly?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pogermiller, the 836 is just, again, best guess.
But you now have better information.
What our returns could be, who knows? We could be down another 18% like we were 2 years ago.
And where would that move the 8.36?
Again, it would be whatever people's projections were at that point in time. It could be actually higher. It could be lower.
Okay.
Generally speaking, human nature is when things are bad, long-term return expectations also come down.
That was kind of the point I was trying to get to.
Yes.
So I'm trying to assess whether the 8.36 is premised on a optimistic view of the future or a pessimistic view of the future?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pogermiller, I think the people from the various firms would say that it's based upon what they think is a realistic. But who knows?
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Bicker?
but inflation is
important. Thank you for coming back and responding to the issues or questions that had been raised. We appreciate that very much. let's see, Mr. Brian Rice has also requested the chance to speak. There he is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian Rice, I'm an attorney. I represent the Minneapolis Police and Firefighters Relief Association, as well as the Minneapolis Police Federation and the professional firefighters. I really hadn't planned on testifying, but Ms. Crockett's testimony really made me feel like I need to at least set the record straight on a couple things. Particularly her statement that her concerns about the merger legislation for Minneapolis Police and Fire that, Mr. Chairman, you were the author of, was somehow something to be afraid of, and her testimony that these pension liabilities are squeezing out other functions. I'm kind of shocked, frankly, because the pension legislation that passed did the exact opposite of what her testimony said. The merger legislation that would be similar to 45 other cities that had local relief associations that went into PRA is simply letting Minneapolis do what, 25 other communities did. There is no subsidy. There's no additional state appropriation to facilitate that. It was not a bailout. There's no increase in aids to make that happen. And I'm flabbergasted at her statement that it's squeezing out other services. The exact opposite happened. The city of Minneapolis will have $17 million less in property tax. Really, it's about $20 million less in property taxes next year because of that legislation, which is going to save commercial industrial owners, residents, renters, millions of dollars next year and $100 million over the next 10 years. And Mayor Ryback, in conjunction with this budget next year, put $45 million more into paving and infrastructure that he didn't have solely because of that legislation. So the exact opposite happened in Minneapolis. By making pension reform, finding a way to be more efficient, there was $45 million in street paving that's going to happen in Minneapolis that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So I appreciate the challenge to Ms. Crockett of saying, let's get some facts there, because she's wrong. That legislation is not costing any more money. It's making it more efficient, and there's going to be infrastructure happening in Minneapolis directly because of the legislation that you passed earlier this year. I appreciate the challenge of some members of the commission that there's been a lot of good facts brought out in the last couple of days about this. Mr. Bickers provided information. The TRA board has. The St. Paul teachers have given you asset returns and talked about it. You know, the study is there. We really ought to be talking about the facts and not trying to stir up fears and other ones. And on that point, the two organizations I represent are going to be consolidated at the end of the year. They have a history over 120 years in the pension business. They have a long collective memory. These funds predated all of the two oldest pension plans in existence right now in the country. They'll be out of business. They predate all the three major funds. They predate the first-class city teacher pension funds. They have a long institutional memory. And Ms. Crockett's testimony that she's talked to police and fire who are interested in going to defined contribution plans. I've represented police and fire for 30 years. I haven't heard any police or fire person talk about that. That's just if to let the record stand that somehow there are police and fire groups in this state that want to change from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan is simply not true. There are 900 Minneapolis police officers, and I represent 1,600 professional firefighters. Not one of those 2,500 members or their representatives have come forward and said, let's get rid of defined benefit and go to defined contribution. So I want this commission, and I want to be on record, that, and I am familiar with other police groups. My firm represents the Highway Patrol on collective bargaining matters and a number of other police unions around the state. Absolutely not true. There are no police and fire in this state that are interested in going to a defined contribution plan. My testimony would be similar to what Mr. Side said. We would be glad to work with the commission. We have worked with the commission. In fact, maybe Mr. Side is gone. He, in the 2010 bill, was somewhat reluctant to have the study that Representative Kiffmeyer proposed as the chief proponent on the House to get the study going. I had a pretty frank conversation with him that I thought having the study would be in all of our interests. There was concern about the pension structure. There wasn't anything to hide, that getting the facts on the table would probably be beneficial to the system, and I think commend you, Mr. Chairman, for holding these hearings. There are a lot of questions still to be asked and facts to be teased out, and I hope that we do that. I do have to say, Ms. Crockett, that I didn't find your testimony particularly helpful. If you want to talk what police and fire want to talk about, I'd ask you to get the representatives here rather than people just anecdotally making statements, because it's just simply not true. And again, on the issue about state being squeezed out, I think one of the most important facts that's been brought forward is 1.6%. Minnesota spends 1.6% of all state and local government budgets on pensions. The national metric is 2.9%. The employees in this state contribute more than the national median for their pensions. The employers contribute less than the national median of employers around the country, and our benefit designs are inferior compared to other states. The teachers group ranks 33 out of 33 in terms of what their formula is. The other metric for public employees and state employees would be similar. That's why we're at 1.6 of state and local government spending goes to pensions when the national metric is 2.9%. I think it's going to be quite hard, frankly, to squeeze any more blood out of that turnip. And if the choice then is to go to defined contribution and wake up this morning, or as Ms. Crockett said, today and tomorrow, and you want to put a quarter of a million state employees on edge every day and have them go to work thinking about, did the Dow open up or did the Dow open down this morning? If that's the mantra that you want to tell your employees to think about every day, is the market up or not? And let me check my, because I've got college-age students too, and I do check this frequently, what the market's doing. If that's what you want your public employees doing at their desks every day, and the teachers, where they're supposed to be teaching, that did the market go up or down, then okay, let's go to defined contribution for everybody. And if you want cops in their cars looking at their Blackberries or iPhones instead of getting the speeder go by, let's do that. And they're not covered by Social Security, by the way. Then let's think about that. And I appreciate your forbearance, Mr. Chair. I think I've worn my welcome out. But part of this issue about pensions also goes to compensation. And we have a comparable work system in this state. It's a system that says everybody ought to be paid relative to what they're worth and what they contribute. And it values education. And when Ms. Crockett talks about these studies, and the Taxpayers Association did a study that showed public employees' salaries are higher than private sector, that's true. Why? You have a lot more educated people in state government that come in. You have teachers. You have state employees, and their education level is considerably higher than the private sector. And one of the mantras is we tell our kids, go to school, get an education, get a good job, it'll pay for itself. Well, you look at the demographics on state and local government employees, they require a more educated workforce. And again, I'll tell you, if you want to pay $10 security guards to be policemen, go ahead and do it. But then you're saying life and death is going to reside in an employee that makes 10 bucks an hour. That's not the way it works. And these private sector analysts saying that you're going to, make government more efficient, there are some functions that government has that the private sector won't do. They don't do police work. They don't do emergency responder work, fire work. They don't do teaching work, and they don't do it very well. There are just selections that government steps in to undertake that the private sector won't do. And so with that, I'll be glad to certainly participate in this. I've been doing this for 30 years and coming to these pension commissions. I appreciate the hearings you've had. I appreciate people who come forward with facts. I've talked to Kim on a number of other occasions, invited her out for breakfast. She's been doing it a year and a half. Well, welcome to the debate. It's a complex area, and a little learning frequently is a dangerous thing.
Okay. I don't want to get into a back and forth here, but I will give Ms. Crockett an opportunity to respond briefly, if you would, to whatever you want to respond to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to get into a back and forth either, but very quickly, I think that Mr. Rice misunderstood what I was saying about the Minneapolis Police and Fire closed funds joining the state para fund. I think he made the point that I was trying to make, which is that if Minneapolis had not shifted to the para funds, they would have been faced with raising taxes and or not doing the street repair and all the other things that Mayor Ryback wants to do, because Representative Smith and Senator Pogemiller had asked me for examples. That, whether you agree with that merger or not, I think it's a good example of how pension issues, and I realize that's a city one and not a state one, have begun to put pressure on government budgets for things like road repairs. And I think that it was that clear, as Mr. Rice testified. It was either move those funds or do the street repairs this year. It was kind of an either-or thing, because the pressure in Minneapolis is to keep those taxes down. And I can't tell you specifics about what the state is facing in those areas, but the information that was provided by the pension funds yesterday indicated that just over the last 5 years, you have had to raise the employer and employee contribution to fully fund ours. So the question is, when you're raising the employer contribution, which is the taxpayers, one of the taxpayers' parts of it, what else aren't you spending in state government? And on the tit for tat for the other things, I think we'll let that wait for another day. I just wanted to clarify that I totally agree with Mr. Rice on the point about Minneapolis Police and Fire. There's a choice between paying for pensions or paying for streets and roads.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Crockett, in your introductory statements this morning, you talked about several new studies, and you referred to the one that Mr. Haverman talked about yesterday, and then I think you talked about two others or one other yesterday you mentioned. Could you send the commission the those studies or the access to those studies?
Sure. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think they're interrelated, though.
Senator, would you use the mic, please, so people can hear?
To the extent that it's a public service, pension, the cost of the employee in delivering the service are interrelated. They're not totally separate. Mm-hmm. And I think the point Representative Kahn made is that to some extent we're paying for the sins of people previous to us by
right.
because they didn't pay the cost
yep.
that they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a pension commission policy for, I don't know, 20 years, I forget how long now, where we are trying to pay the current cost so that it's not a shift between generations.
Right.
So,
and I think that there's been plenty of testimony that Minnesota has certainly got a better report card on that type of discipline and paying the normal cost each year. And I don't know who would have the information. I believe Mr. Martin would on what the history is of that, so that we would understand better why we have the unfunded liabilities that we do. But again, paying the normal cost every year isn't the only factor in, you know, where we are in terms of the unfunded liabilities. So.
Thank you.
Well.
Not seeing no one else that wished to be heard, we're going to move on with our agenda. And Senator Pappas, glad you were able to join us today. We understand you were out of the area yesterday and appreciate your ability to be here with us today. We will move on with the agenda. And Mr. Martin.
Members, this would be number two on your September 22nd portion of the agenda. This is an update on the Commission's budget and appropriation, and then also a discussion or a presentation of options that you have with respect to reinstituting a contract with the actuarial firm that previously was the retained actuary for the Pension Commission. If I was going to do a textbook version of how the Commission's budget allocation is or funding is set and how the budget gets set, compared it to what happened this year, it would be radically different. Normally, the Commission is more involved in putting together a budget request. It goes up through a process and ultimately gets disposed by the budget committees. In the state government bill. This year, because of the lateness of the commission and other factors, the budget was largely set without reference or without much input from the commission. The commission staff was given the responsibility to put together a 5% reduction budget request, which we did. And ultimately, it was a 5% budget reduction request that was ultimately appropriated to the LCC, the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And on the first page of the memo, you have the total budget for the commission, $948,000 for the biennium, $474,000 for each year. And following an incremental process, the allocation that I gave the LCC of that $474,000, and most of it, 78, almost 80% of it, is personnel costs. Just shy of 20% is related to the actuarial consultants, and the remainder, a modest amount, interim meeting expenses and office expenses. So what you see there is for purposes of the LCC keeping track of our budget, this is how it's been allocated. Assuming that you folks, I'm now moving to the bottom of page one, assuming that the commission in attempting to reinstitute the contract with Milliman, And I should mention, when the budget was uncertain in March, and there were discussions of maybe a 9% reduction in the commission's budget rather than a 5% our reduction, we could live with a 5% our reduction, still retain the actuary and have the actuary do everything that we had previously contracted with the actuary to do. But it would only be the required tasks in the main that could occur. When there was a prospect of a 9% budget reduction, we could not have the actuary continue doing the things that had been provided for back in the a couple of years ago when we put in place a four-year contract with the actuarial firm. I, on behalf of the commission, exercise the commission's authority to terminate the contract with Milliman. It needs to be reinstituted if we're going to make use of Milliman for the remaining 2 years of the planned four-year period. And this is the opportunity at this point, if you want to jigger with the duties of the actuary, to create some space for special projects. You have before you both the benefit design issue and the actuarial assumption change issues. Both of those may well have a significant pertinent portion that you might want to look to the commission actuary for help and guidance and data runs and other sorts of information. So assuming that the roughly $5,000 that's in the that's left over at the moment for special projects is insufficient, if you want to do have more for special projects, that means doing less of the recurring items that we've had contracted with the actuary for in the past. And I've asked I put together a couple of options of a scaled back set of duties. I asked the actuary if there were additional things they could identify. In the end, there were four options that were presented to me, and I've had them for you. There, in the very last page of this packet item, it's a small letter-sized document. It follows the draft contract. There's an item that we have from the actuary, which gives you what the tasks are for the current canceled contract and the four options that Milliman has costed out for us. Options one and two are options that I cooked up. I suggested a scaled back, a delaying of some of the tasks that would otherwise occur. And options three and four are suggestions that Milliman has come up with. What our actuary does for us, what was the result of late 2000s legislation, is that our actuary does not do the regular actuarial work of the Minnesota pension plans, but does an auditing and reviewing function. The audit is done by a replication valuation for a selected plan or plans. Our actuary does the same valuation that the primary actuarial consultant does, and then when the results don't agree or if the results that Milliman produces don't confirm what the existing actuary, the primary actuary, has done, then there's a reconciliation or an attempt to resolve what the differences are, if those differences are a lack of conformity with state law or actuarial standards requirements. Those can be corrected. If it's something else, then there's some other resolution of the problem. We had on schedule to do replications in 2012 of TRA and the two first-class city teacher plans, and then replications in 2013 of the four public safety type pension plans. Beyond the replications, there would be our reviews. The actuary would look at the results of the primary actuarial work and would assess whether they're reasonable and consistent. And any of the plans that are not replicated would be under a normal review process, under the old contractual system. Options one and two that I put together would be delaying the police and fire replications and just doing the first, just doing the teacher plans, but spreading them over the 2 years instead of doing them in a single year. So option one is TRA in the first year, 12, and the first class city teacher plans in 13. Option two is flipping that and doing the first class city teacher plans in 12 and TRA in 13 and reviews of all the balance. What Milliman has come up with in options three or four is that same sort of delay in the replications for the teacher plans, doing TRA first and then doing the first class city teachers in 13, and scaling back on the number of reviews that are done. Option three is a more modest scaling back, and option four is a considerable scaling back in the reviews. I have on page two of the memo, in the middle of page two, given you a sense of what the actuary is telling us as how much would be freed up for a special projects budget, depending on what option you would do. Option one produces over the biennium about $18,200, as does option two. So essentially you're looking at the money saved out of the current system plus the roughly $5,000 that's in the budget for special projects beyond what we would have been contracted to do, about $18,000 in options one and two, either one. Option three is for the biennium, about $47,000 would be freed up for the biennium, and in option four, it would be about almost $67,000 would be freed up for the biennium. Because this is a legislative budget issue, something that the legislature can do that state agencies, as I understand it, don't do is we can spend fiscal 13 money in fiscal 12. The appropriation is for the entire biennium, and you can move some money in effect that otherwise would be fiscal 13 money into fiscal 12. So you could, if you wanted to spend the entire biennial actuarial budget in 12, you can do that. It does require some accounting attention by the LCC, but that, my understanding in consulting with Mr. Hubinger, that's what is permitted. So if you you can structure the work of the commission over both years of the biennium, but recognizing that the second year of the biennium is a general election year and historically has meant fewer commission meetings and less of the burden of trying to put together alternative proposals or pension legislation. The first year of the biennium is usually the heavier. That just to let you know that you can front load the actuarial work if you were to want to create a special project budget. We do have with us today Mr. Herman from Milliman. He is one of the actuaries assigned to our account when we were still under contract with Milliman. He's here at his own expense and in his own interest. But I'm sure on this question, if there are any questions that members have about the options, especially options three and four that Milliman has assembled for us, he may well be able to provide some answers. So I think the question here for you, if we're going to have Milliman back under contract, we need to decide whether we want to continue the prior four-year contract, essentially do what's provided for in the canceled column, or if you want to create more than roughly the $5,000 that is there for special projects budget, which of the options would you like to pursue in order to create a more of a margin for special projects?
Well, I think that this analysis is very helpful, and in order to address the question, it seems to me we have to have some sense from the Commission as to what some potential special projects might be that we would want the actuarial firm to do. For example, obviously, if we want to take any look at any particular hybrid plan, that would require money for the actuarial work that would be required. If we want to take a closer look at any potential change in any of the assumptions, be it earnings assumptions or salary or growth assumptions, that we would need to have resources to do that. And Mr. Martin, do we have any sense as to what any of those kinds of analyses might cost, so that we would have some sense of how much we really need to sort of have available? It would seem to me that $5,000, as is currently there, is not going to enable us to do much of anything with regard to any analysis by an actuarial firm. And so do we have some sense as to what any of those other ideas might cost?
Members, with Mr. Chair, with special projects, unless we ask the actuary to give us a bid on a particular task, the way that they're usually handled is on a per hour rate basis. How much work the actuary needs to pursue to do the task. There is a draft contract. It's a letter-sized document with a lot of red and black printing on it. If you can find pages 22 and 23 of that document, there on the bottom of 22 and the top of 23 is the hourly rates for various components, various professionals within the consulting actuarial firm. I mean, the easy answer is it's not cheap to have special projects done because it is on a per individual utilization basis. And to the extent that the primary or secondary actuaries are involved, we're talking about fairly hefty hourly rates. It's very hard to know abstractly what sort of special project costs would be because it really depends upon how many pension plans, how intricate you want the actuarial work. So all I can really give you is guidance. It's relatively expensive to do special projects.
Yeah. Well, the other question that needs to be applied here is if we shift some of the resources available to special projects, are we running the risk of not getting the regular job done that we need to on some of these areas, particularly going over to options 3 and 4? What are the implications of scaling back some of that really regular work?
Mr. Chair, the pension plans that have the greatest impact on the state budget and our concerns are the biggest of the pension plans. We've done the replication the most recent year of MSRS General, PERA General, and the MRF Division. The only other major plan that we have not yet done is TRA, of the ones that have large liabilities and large memberships. So TRA has also changed their actuary this year, so we're looking at a different actuarial firm than had done the actuarial work for prior years. So in any of these, other than option 2, we're going to do TRA up front the following year, and that So I think we've covered the bulk of liability and the bulk of concern in options 1, 3, or 4. Option 3 would not do reviews of some of the more modest size pension plans that have the least impact on state budgets and are presumably less concerned. The elected state officers, the remainder of the constitutional officer plan, the other legislators plan would not be done, the judges plan would not be done, the MSRS correctional plan would not be looked at, PERA correctional plan would not be reviewed under options 3, and it's an even more scaled back under 4. It's a really bare bones in option 4. I would be more comfortable probably with 3 if you were to, simply because it's there are things that can happen in some of the plans that would not be looked at that probably ought to be looked at. And so if we did option 4, we're running about as close to the margin as one possibly could.
Representative Kahn.
I don't remember now if we've ever done this or if it's something that I've suggested in the past and have been beaten down on, but just looking at another method of financing, I wondered if we could finance the actuarial costs by calling for a percentage contribution from each pension plan based on what the size of their budget is, on the sense that they may have a more flexible budget than we have. I don't know if there... It was just that we did... Yes, I know I've brought it up before. The question is, I don't remember. I don't remember why it was discarded, or is maybe this the appropriate time to bring it up?
Well, that's a good question. And
Chair,
has it been done before?
Yes. And there's a cautionary tale, probably. Back in 1984, when the legislature decided to have the Pension Commission actuary be the primary actuary for the valuations, the legislature appropriated the entire required funding for that. Over time, as the legislative budgets were being cut, we started instituting a charge against the pension funds and ultimately had them paying virtually all of the cost of the primary actuarial work. Then when it became impossible to, the budget cuts for the commission were such that we either could have an actuary or we could have a staff, but you could not have both. Representative Smith was chair at the time, and the decision was made to hand off the actuarial process to an actuary who was retained jointly by the various pension funds. And again, they have a single actuary doing all the valuations, but would be funded by the pension funds and selected by the pension funds jointly. That lasted 2 or 3 years, and the pension funds came back and wanted to disband the jointly retained actuary and to each retain their separate actuary as they saw fit. And that was enacted in 2008 or 2009. So we have charged back these sorts of costs in the past. Although the fact that I can recoup money, or in the old days, could recoup money from the pension funds, which would reimburse the general fund for that outlay of dollars, in the budget process, it's not set up that's recognized as part of the commission's budget. And so I would still get an overall budget reduction, which would include the money that was being recouped. And that's how it kept the overall hole kept being made smaller and smaller, even though I could recoup 100% of a portion of it. That was never taken into account, and hence left us in the current situation. There's no reason to believe that problem wouldn't continue if you were to start installing some sort of fund fixed fee again, that if commission budgets were to be reduced, that it wouldn't, that it would adequately capture that extra revenue.
Well,
Lynn City Branch doesn't usually generate revenue, so the system is not well set up to handle that.
Well,
Representative Cobb.
Mr. Chairman, all that means is that we have to write the law in a way so that it works, and so that the regenerated, that we are not charged for the regenerated revenue. Obviously, it's not something we can do right now. We need another legislative session to do it, but I haven't really heard any reason why we can't do it, except that we didn't write a law properly to take that into account.
Representative Connor, I'm not sure I would be the person to suggest why you can't do it, or why you might not want to do it. I'm sure there are fund representatives here who could tell you why they wouldn't like it to be done.
Well, I think we should hear what they say, but I don't think we should say that, you know, again, when you look at the tiny percentage of their budget compared to the percentage of the Legislative Coordinating Commission's budget, it just seems like a sensible thing to do, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't hear anyone who wants to object to it, but it doesn't mean we ought to just accept those objections. And I don't hear anything that you said that I don't think we could, you know, that we could fix it with proper attention to the details of the wording.
Obviously, if we were to look to the funds to help fund some of this, that we're going to have further discussion down the road that we can't probably have or have a full discussion about that now. We need to take action today, yeah. Do we not, on approving the budget and approving what our target here is going to be with regard to special projects. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, if you want to have the actuary put back under contract and to get underway in doing the reviews and the replications that would normally, or some portion of the reviews and replications that would normally be done, it would be a good idea to do it now, although it could wait. I don't know what time constraints that places Milliman in. They have other work that they do for other clients. That would normally be spread over a six-month period, July 1 through the end of the year. We're already constraining that by now being in September, and so they've got to do whatever we're asking them to do between now and the end of the year. If you would let this go to October, it just becomes a much smaller period of time.
Yeah.
Mr. Herman may be able to give us some sense of whether that's a real problem, or can they juggle it. So the only urgency is that if you want them, Milliman, to be under contract doing some of the regular recurring items that they would do, and if you wanted them to get started on a special project rather than waiting until not being able to get started until after the October meeting, those would be the urgencies.
Yeah.
I would think that we'd want to get them started would be my thinking. Mr. Herman, did you wish to address the commission and make any comments at all about the discussion that we're having here? To give you the opportunity, if you would, recognizing that you're here on your own dime, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I can just make my suggestion would be to go ahead and do the contract at this time, with knowing that we have the option if we want to move to this other way of doing it, of adding things, but we could not add that with any certainty until after the session started. Mm-hmm. If not, and you know, possibly not even until the end of the session, knowing what happens to appropriations bills. Depends if you can do this, use the Wisconsin trick of having this not be an appropriations bill, just a little piece of legislation that modifies things.
Mr. Herman, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Tim Herman. I'm an actuary with Milliman. The only real comment that I do have regarding the discussion you've had so far is with respect to the work that would be contemplated for the current year. If you were to make a decision today to reinstate the contract, we would be able to continue to deliver the services at the agreed-upon time frame. If you were to delay that decision to a later delay, it would be very difficult to deliver the results of our review in a timely fashion. That would be the most significant comment that I would have at this point.
Okay. Thank you. Well, that. What's the pleasure of the group?
Mr.
We can go ahead and I think we should go ahead and renew the contract. The question is, what kind of target do we want to have for special projects here? Senator Pogamiller.
Just a quick question for Mr. Herman. Did Ms. Beckman retire or just move on to a different account or what?
Mr. Herman?
Ms. Beckman is no longer with Melamine.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Beckman has actually been retained as the TRA actuary. She went to a different firm, and that firm is the new actuary that will be doing TRA's work.
What's the pleasure of the commission? What would you like to do?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I think the motion you suggested is the appropriate one. Why don't you just repeat it in a way so we can pass it?
Okay, the appropriate motion, Mr. Martin, would be what then at this point?
To authorize the chair to execute on behalf of the commission a contract with Milliman implementing option, whatever option it is that the commission wants to pursue.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think at this time it seems like I would rather try and keep a little more flexibility going forward. I think we can add in tasks easier, and I think if we chose a more limited version at this time, it preserves an option for October and ever to maybe add some things back, but I think it seems that if we started out with a more limited version, then we can add in, that'll give us time to take a look at some of these other things that we may want to do. But I think it gives us greater flexibility, and I think at this time we really need that flexibility, and I think option four kind of gives us that, or three.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Martin recommends three over four, as correct? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm a little more comfortable with three in not leaving as many pension plans unreviewed for 2012.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be fine. Three would be fine then.
So you've heard the suggested motion. Would someone care to move any motion here?
So moved.
Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, so moved. Option three.
Option three. Discussion to the motion. So we're resuming the contract with Milliman, and we're following a strategy of option three. Any further discussion? Representative Murphy.
If we have option three, which Representative Kiffmeyer says gives us more flexibility to add things in, does that give Milliman the time, the option within the front, or the time, if we add things in, does that give them enough time to conclude the contract?
Mr. Herman, would you care to respond to that question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy. The answer is it depends. It depends on how soon you want us to be adding stuff in for the current fiscal year. So, for example, if you were to move, if your choice was to go add more pieces back in, say, for example, move from option three back to option two, move from option three to option one, it would be far easier for us than going from option three to option two. The main difference between those two are the replication valuations that we were doing under those two different options. There's a lot more of the work that goes into a replication evaluation. So it'd be easier for us to add in the limited scope review in the current fiscal year than it would be to switch gears and do a different replication evaluation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would suspect also that getting a decision made today, and at least you get to going on what you do know about, is very valuable to that whole thing, too, because you can at least have the certainty of going forward on kind of a basic plan, and also the largest ones. I believe it's the smaller ones that are there, which we could select, but this would take care of some of the larger ones. I would suspect that making that decision today, at least, would be very helpful on timing.
That is correct. It's my understanding that the fund administrators have been holding off on sending census yield to us pending reinstatement of the contract. So that would at least allow us to get going on the initial part of our work.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy.
Tell me again if we have the additional money in the
for special projects?
For special projects, yes. Mm-hmm. Then, and you said that we could spend special projects in 13 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we have to do special projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, no. Special projects would be assigned by either the chair or by me. They would only be assigning a special project if the commission wanted to do something in particular. So we're not obligating the state to expend any of the special projects budget by doing what you're looking at here. It would take an extra action like any special project. It would have to be an assignment letter from me to Milliman telling them what I wanted them to do and authorizing them to do that special project. On page 2, in the middle of the page, there is a reference to Minnesota Statute Section 16A.281. That's what I'm told authorizes legislative entities to spend money in either year of the biennium from their appropriation. And ours is an allocation of a bigger appropriation to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. We don't technically get an appropriation straight on. Ours is a portion of the LCC budget. And what you see on page 1 is our allocation from the LCC.
It would seem to me that the motion before us is to resume the contract with Milliman. And for option 3, it would seem to me that if we wanted to move back or in effect, scale down our special projects possibility and go down to option 1, as Mr. Herman recommended, that we probably would need to do that at the October meeting. Am I correct in that assumption, Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, I mean, it's probably technically possible to do it in the November meeting with an extended deadline date for the reporting of the results of any added work that you would add to them. I'm speaking out of turn. Mr. Herman actually knows physically what it takes to turn these reports out. But my sense is that November isn't that much different than October.
Okay.
If you delayed by the equivalent amount of time, the due date on these things.
Well, that would...
You're not coming into session until a little later. Then when we set the four-year contract up, we didn't know when the legislature would be coming back in on the even years. So it's actually set up for more of a January start than it is for a late January, early February start. So I don't think it throws your schedule off by having a delay if Milliman were to be given the
Mr. Herman, would that work, that you recommended that if we scale back the special projects that we would need to go to option 1 instead of option 2. If we made that decision in November, is that a problem?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin speaking very well on my behalf. We would request an extended deadline.
Pardon me?
We would request an extended deadline if you did make the decision in November.
And if it were November?
If you did delay the decision to add additional work in, we would request a deadline extension if that decision was made in November.
Okay.
I'll just withdraw my motion so that you have a blank slate to do what you want, Mr. Chair. My motion was free. I'll withdraw it if you want to go to one, whatever.
Well, I'm not suggesting we roll back to one.
Exploring the options. All right.
Just exploring the options.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that.
Okay, I'll leave it on unless someone suggests.
Okay. Okay, further discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, is this what you want to do?
I think this is a reasonable approach.
Okay.
The motion is that we resume the contract with Milliman, sign the contract with Milliman, based on the option three, recognizing that we can make an adjustment later if we choose to do that.
Great.
Okay?
That's my motion.
Okay. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Mr. Martin, do we need an official motion on the budget too at this point? No. Okay.
The budget was simply an update telling you how I've allocated the money that was that had been apportioned to the commission. Unless you wanted to change the way that allocation, that apportioning that I did, unless you wanted to change that, then it would be appropriate to do something now. But to tell me to do something different. To do something different means we put more money into some other line and take it out of presumably staff salaries.
Okay.
With it.
So everybody comfortable with the budget that has been before us here? Okay. We will then move on to the next agenda item. And Senator Rosen, would you give me a break for 2 minutes?
Oh, I said aye.
And chair of the meeting. I'll be right back.
My dog needs a break, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, members. We are on number three on the agenda. The consideration of demographic actuarial assumptions for PRA. And do we have a...
Members, in your packet there is a very short memo describing a motion that's attached to my memo. And there's also clipped on the experience study for the PERA police and fire plan. The experience study from PERA Police and Fire was done as a special project by the pension fund involved. It came in at a somewhat different time than the other three normally required quadrennial experience studies, so this is processed a little out of that order. It was not reviewed by Milliman because it came in at a later time. Statutory changes, which is principally salary increase and payroll growth, were made in last year's omnibus pension bill for PERA Police and Fire. So what is at stake here is the remainder of the experience study recommendations relating to the demographic assumptions, the non-economic assumptions. It would be appropriate to have Ms. Vanek come down and briefly comment or briefly summarize the work of the actuary and what you have as a motion M1, which is the third page of the page following page 2 of the staff memo, gives you the motion that would be appropriate to approve the actuarial assumption changes that were recommended by Mercer, the actuary retained by PERA, which did the PRA Police and Fire experience study.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and members, I briefly mentioned this to you in one of the meetings you had during session when you did put into the bill our salary and our payroll growth assumptions. These are the other assumptions, the demographic assumptions that are important to incorporate also. The major one here is mortality. We have to recognize the improvement in mortality in our plans on a regular basis, and what the commission what our actuary has recommended and the commission's actuary reviewed as part of the general plan assumption changes are incorporated here, and that is a progressive recognition of mortality improvements over time. So we need that to be adopted. We also reviewed our retirement-related experiences and found that we were now seeing more retirements at age 50 than we had previously experienced. So that's being recognized in the assumption changes. Those are the two most significant demographic changes that we are making as part of the motion today that we're asking you to support. I can tell you that the numbers I presented to you yesterday in terms of the funded ratio of the Police and Fire Fund and the contribution deficiency already recognize these changes. If you don't adopt the changes we're asking you to adopt, specifically with respect to mortality, our deficiency numbers will look better, but it's going to flow through at some point and affect the funding of the plan.
Questions for Spanik? Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I was kind of shocked when you said that, and then I realized we're talking about police and fire, but do you have any anecdotal information about why police and fire are retiring at 50?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, staff observes application processes, and it is it has been since we modified our disability provisions and made them a little more restrictive that we are now experiencing more retirements at age 50. We saw a lot of disability applications, and they aligned with the law. We had to approve them in the late 90s, early part, mid-2000s. In 2006 and then again in 2007, we came before the commission with recommendations to tighten up our disability provisions, and now we're seeing more of those individuals moving into early retirement options instead. So age 50 and then up to age 55, it's in between the two. Our expectations are being met, but at age 50, our numbers are higher. I will be anxious to see the experience that we have going forward, given the economic conditions, because these individuals do a good job of supplementing their income through deferred comp savings and other opportunities, and I would expect that that's going to show up to show later retirements, but we'll watch that and we'll see when we do the next study.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering, are these then people going into second careers before they get disabled, or they're too disabled to continue these high-risk jobs but not disabled enough to get disability? Hard to tell, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, our former disability provisions really were allowed individuals who had been injured many years before to apply for disability benefits at a point when they decided they wanted to leave the workforce. Even though the disability wasn't as limiting as what we had historically expected that benefit to cover. And it was the law. It was certainly not available to these individuals to use that as a way of leaving the public safety workforce rather than taking the early retirement reduction and leaving early. We don't track if they're not if they're on a disability benefit. We will track if they are working elsewhere. It doesn't matter if they're in public sector employment or other employment. We do track their earnings. There are limitations on how much they can make and collect their disability benefit. If they retire early, there's no tracking of what they're doing elsewhere, so we wouldn't really have a good idea of what they're doing beyond retirement.
Any other questions for Ms. Vanek? If not, what is the pleasure of the group with regard to the proposed motion?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption.
Representative Murphy moves that we adopt the motion that would approve the demographic actuarial assumption changes recommended by the actuarial firm of Mercer and requested by PERA. Discussion. Senator, we're voting on the proposed motion. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you,
Ms. Panik. Ms. Martin.
Members, those are the two things that you have specific for today's agenda. The rest of the time is either resumed consideration of anything you didn't do yesterday, which I think is primarily identification of potential issues for the interim, either by the commission or by other interested parties.
Well, members, yesterday we thank you for a very good day yesterday to all of the fund representatives and citizens and advocates that came before us. I felt we had a very productive day. There are a couple of questions that remain before us. The first is, do we wish to do any further analysis of any options relative to hybrid, for example, on defined benefit, defined contribution? Obviously, I think most of what we've heard seems to suggest that sticking with the defined benefit is perhaps the most prudent thing at this point in time. The question, I think, really before us as a commission is, do we wish to give any further analysis to any kind of hybrid where new hirees, for example, in the future might come under some other different plan? So that's question one, and whether or not we want to give any further attention to that. And secondly, with regard to the assumption changes, especially on the earnings, 8.5%, to what extent we want to give further consideration of that. We didn't spend a lot of time discussing the salary assumptions, the growth in workforce assumptions. It seems to me that those are also important things that are in statute that we may want to give further consideration to. So those are a couple of the key questions following up yesterday that are still before us. Then what I wanted to have us do is have some discussion about what do you want to do next month? What kinds of issues, what kinds of analyses do you want to see conducted as we come together in October? Obviously, there are a whole host of other issues that are there before us that we may want to give consideration to. So those are the questions before you at this point, and we'll just open the floor and see where you're at. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, what would be involved or what has been suggested to take a good review of the hybrid model? I know Representative Kiffmeyer was talking about getting some studies, but can we just, what do we need to accumulate or study as far as, or ask staff to take a look at?
Well, I think the first question is what kind of interest is there in looking at hybrid options?
Mm-hmm.
And if there is interest, which what kind of an option, what would be the parameters of an option that we would want to take further look at? And then we would need to get some advice from our experts on how we might go about trying to do that analysis. Does that address your question?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I could add something at
Mr.
this
Martin.
Point, Mr. Chair. The hybrid that you were talking about yesterday, as Ms. Hacking, I believe, referred to them, you have two options with a hybrid. If you're having a defined benefit plus something, it's either a stacking proposition or it's a side-by-side. The side-by-side, it seems to be, from a technical standpoint, more difficult to engineer. What you're trying to do is reduce the benefit program, scale it back to free up a certain amount of money, which could then be the contribution stream for a defined contribution add-on. And it's a little hard to disentangle the costs of an existing defined benefit plan to reduce it down to a set amount and then have it necessarily stay at that reduced cost. The costs are the benefits you promise as applied to the people that it applies to, and the thing you can't control very easily is how this population is going to grow. We don't know if government is going to exactly replace current employees who choose to retire, expand, contract, whatever it might do. The stacking seems to be an easier thing to do as a practical matter. If you limit the current defined benefit plan to some salary level, so it's defined benefit on salaries up to dollar whatever it is, and then defined contribution on contributions on all salary above whatever that level is, you don't have to surgically excise out things and try and figure out costs. You've almost automatically figured out how you're going to do that. So I think the next decision you might want to make is if it's a hybrid and it's not, and it's going to be this the hybrid that was described by Ms. Hacking, the choice between either stacking, trying a stacking hybrid versus a side-by-side, I think is the next choice you might want to make or might want to think about exploring.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, I really appreciated the study that came forward. I think it gave us a lot of good insight, but I think the one thing we don't have is a viable study of that kind of hybrid thing, and I think it would have been very difficult for them to have done too many variations. It's, I think, really difficult. You start with one, you got it. But it seems as though this stacking or the DBDC kind of version, only learning lessons from everybody else, that I think Mr. Martin could well kind of pick out what are some of those things that we can do, having the SBI mutual fund that, you know, people can do instead of kind of picking and choosing. I mean, when you're creating these sorts of things and it's a state program, you can make parameters. You're free to do that and free to learn from the others and to do that. And I would certainly not want to just take a boilerplate from somewhere else and just pop it in and do that. I would want to have our staff kind of weigh in on a DBDC kind of a hybrid and maybe in October do a little thinking about what a proposed project might look like. I don't think I have the wherewithal to kind of pick through all that, which I think our staff and the knowledge that they have do. But I think that if we had something come forward in October that would kind of have an outline structure of something like that, and then we can still decide whether we want to go that way, but it's kind of hard to do when you have nothing at all. But I think if we chose, say, stacking instead of the side-by-side, which seems to be thoughtful, there's some of the Nebraska thing, there's some things that Mr. Bicker has mentioned that if you were to do that, I have ideas on even our current system, if we were going to go that way, to make sure that we do plan for the future and strength and all that. And for the tough times, we've had the 80s and the 90s, and then the millennial year and the last 30 years of stock returns. We've had 20 really good years, pretty much, and then a one tough year. Is that going to be the true for the next 30 years? So when you're looking forward, I think that's a consideration. But nonetheless, for us in a decision-making, I think using some of these special project funds to do that, but doing it thoughtfully, having an approach brought to us by the staff based on the stacking, DBDC, lessons learned, come back to us in October for Mr. Martin and kind of give us a bit of an outline of what he thinks might be mm-hmm. possible, and including Mr. Bicker's insights, too.
Yeah. Well, we could ask staff and ask the funds to consult on mm-hmm. what a possible stacking hybrid might look like and bring that back for discussion in October. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are two things that come to my mind as we have these discussions and struggle to try to figure out what the right answer is, and it's number one is what are the goals and objectives we want to achieve through our retirement plans? And I don't profess to know all of the answers, what each of those goals and objectives are. The other is, I heard mentioned 85% of pre-retirement working age income is one of the numbers, one of the goals. And defining retiring with dignity, what is that definition? Is 85% of pre-retirement working age income the right number? What should it be? Is that right? What is the definition of retiring with dignity? Are we achieving that? And I don't have the answer, but I think it's worth discussion.
To what extent do the funds have already a set of established goals? Ms. Martin? Retirement goals for the funds?
Well, members, we do have there is the Commission's Principles of Pension Policy, which express a preference for defined benefit plans over defined contribution plans. And I suppose that runs to the goals. By pursuing defined benefit plans rather than defined contribution plans, you're emphasizing benefit adequacy, some measure of the output of the pension plan over the input, the cost of the plan. The principles of the pension policy principles do count in the sense that they don't define in a very clear way what adequacy is. They talk about adequacy being the combination of the pension plan and any Social Security that's provided, and they do target in the individual as somebody who's retiring at the normal retirement age with 30 years of service credit, that we don't have an obligation to provide a fully adequate benefit to somebody who retires earlier than that or somebody who retires with less service than that. But it doesn't actually specify, it doesn't necessarily utilize the replacement of pre-retirement income as its measure. It also does suggest that this all has to be done within the confines of affordability, which it also doesn't particularly define. So what the Commission has talked about, you have to derive more what we're up to from what the Commission has approved over time than what we've put in bold print, because we've left a few items to be punted or to be figured out as we go, not specifying what the measure of adequacy might be. In the academic community, there are differences, or there are some arguments about what constitutes an adequate benefit. It's an older notion, or it's a more established notion, that it's the standard of living that a person has pre-retirement ought to be substantially replaced after retirement. That's the replacement ratio, or the replacement percentage of pre-retirement income. But is that somebody's final year of salary? Is that their last period of years that you want to replace? Some of those questions. There's been other discussion in the academic community about looking at retirees who don't spend their money, don't actually utilize their retirement benefits consistently all the way through their retirement doing the same thing, that individuals who newly retire will pursue things like travel and other pursuits or hobbies or whatever at the first portion of their retirement, and at the end of their retirement, it's more long-term care and it's not doing things like traveling. And so there are probably at least three decided periods of a retiree that that would normally occur and a flat rate replacement doesn't do a very good job of necessarily targeting that. So they've raised this. Nobody is, or I have not seen a whole lot of attempt to try and derive what that would look like as an actual benefit amount, how you would translate that into a formula. The replacement ratio translates nicely. If you think 85% is the right amount, you subtract out what Social Security will provide, and it becomes then just a fairly straightforward mathematical question of how much, what percentage of final average salary do you provide per year to get you to the right spot. It's an easy academic issue, but it doesn't necessarily match what people are doing.
Senator?
Not necessarily on that topic, but as far as October, some initial discussion of the impact, if any, of the GASB rulings on these funds.
To that, Mr. Martin, recognizing that that has not been finalized yet, what can you tell us about where that's at and what the plan is to get that whole set of GASB issues resolved?
Members, I can get you part of the way there, and maybe other folks might be some help. What GASB is looking at is changing the accounting standards for what is reported by the employing units with respect to pension coverage. And they have standards in place for what the pension plan has to report. And now it's what's the disclosure of pension liabilities and pension costs employer by employer, where for the state of Minnesota, this is not particularly complicated. We're, by and large, a single employer set of pension plans. Most of the people in MSRS General are state employees, though there's some university employees and some Met Council. With MSRS Correctional, it's entirely the state of Minnesota. So already, whatever disclosure there is for the pension plan translates nicely into the employer disclosure. PERA, which is a multiple employer pension plan covering 500,000, 600,000, 800,000 governmental units, what portion of PERA's unfunded is attributable to Williams, Minnesota, or Elk River, Minnesota, or Moorhead? What portion of the cost would be attributable? And that, I think, is where the complexity comes. I have not gone through specifically the recommended or the exposure draft version of this, so I can't get to any level of detail beyond that. That it's what we're really looking at is what the employing units have to disclose, and the implications are more okay if Moorhead, which never had to put anything on its disclosure other than we're in PERA and see the PERA annual financial report if you want to know more. Now that they have to ascribe certain portion of PERA's unfunded to Moorhead, that's going to have ramifications for Moorhead.
Yeah. Is this something that would be good for us to dig into more in October or November or
I think it
after
would be
the first of the year?
I think, members, it would be appropriate at some point to have either the State Auditor's Office or the Legislative Auditor's Office or jointly have them tell us. They are our set of accountants for pensions. The State Auditor's Shop does local plans. The Legislative Auditor's Shop does the statewide plans. Those folks follow this greatly, and we may as well make use of the in-house expertise that we have.
So we might ask them.
And we could ask them to make a presentation. And
whether
I think
October
would
or November would be better.
Yep.
Okay, that's an option. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, could we have a presentation on the cash balance plan from Nebraska?
Yeah, you're suggesting that we take that up next time?
If we have
to get some kind of presentation on that?
Yes. Option. And also, my other question was, what would be your preference of what should be complete by the time we hit session? What would you like to have? We had a list of many pension proposals at the last the last session, and we only picked out the ones that needed immediate attention. Are we going to have a chance to go through those again and have a hearings, or what would you like to do?
Well, thanks for the question. What I think would be helpful is the time of our last meeting in November, that if there are some significant policy adjustments or reforms or whatever that we would like to pursue, that we should have those identified by the time we finish up in November. And as I said earlier, I don't think I had not envisioned that we would be hearing individual bills this fall, that we wouldn't be hearing individual bills. But if people have some policy issues that are of significance, we ought to be focused on that this fall. And when it comes to individual bills, we're not going to start hearing those until January. And frankly, I think we ought to start hearing bills right away, because we have a backlog from last year, and a number of our colleagues were disappointed that they weren't able to get a hearing because we didn't have time. And so I think we ought to start hearing individual bills right away when we start the session. So by the end of November's meeting, I would hope that if there are some significant policy reforms or ideas that we want to pursue, that we would have those identified and maybe wouldn't have them all wrapped up in terms of a proposal, but at least have a, in concept anyway, some things we'd like to do. Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, for possible ideas to complete what we were just talking about with Mr. Martin, is there someone or some group or some people that have an idea of what the private sector pensions produce? And is there can they make a comparison? Or at least we hear about private sector. I heard today that someone was, I think it was Ms. Crockett, that said that we should have that public pensions should be competitive with private pensions. And does that mean that private pensions are above public pensions, or public pensions above private pensions? I don't even know how many employers have offer private pensions anymore. They used to, but now people are telling me that they're dropping them, and that there's no loyalty to the employee anymore, or the employee doesn't have loyalty to the employer anymore because pensions are gone. And so I think if somebody has some expertise on how pensions have changed or what's happening in the current market, I'd like to hear it.
Members, if I could, at this point, I have taken a look at what seems to be available as far as research by other entities, and I'm aware of a few possible sources which I could try and summarize for you. The Government Accounting Office faces this question frequently from Congress, trying to figure out what Congress wants to do with the federal pension programs. They look to what seems to be the trend in the private sector, so there is some information there. The budget, the Census Bureau does do census information. Commerce Department also does, and Labor Departments do some information as to costs and other things. I suspect when you're using the word pension, when constituents or other people are talking to you, they probably mean the traditional defined benefit plan, where the private sector has, to a large measure, gone to 401ks, profit sharing, defined contribution arrangements of one sort or another. There is a fair amount of information about how prevalent they are from the Employee Benefit Research Institute, some other sources. So I would be happy to pull together for you what I can find readily and see if that helps. And to get that out in advance of the October meeting so that if someone clearly pops up who would be local or easily obtained, we then could pursue having someone specifically testify.
Yeah, I think we have to have a better background. If we're going to consider the hybrid at all, we have to have a better background of what's up in the private sector. Yeah.
That's a very good point. And there have been some studies, and it's been a while since I looked at these, that of what's offered in Minnesota in the private sector. And maybe we could identify who it is that has done that work and have them come forward and explain to us what they have found in their analysis of just Minnesota. I mean, I think it's good to know on a national basis, but I think it's also very good to know what's happening in Minnesota. Yep.
And that would definitely pertain to anything that we're going to do in the future. I'd also like to say that I think Senator's point on the 80% or 85% would be a good thing to talk about too, because that's a traditional thing that we've kind of said that the pension fund should, or with the combination of Social Security, the pension, and the savings and all so forth, it has to be 80% of what they were making. Maybe we should talk about what's included in that 80%.
Okay, well, that gets to Senator Chamberlain's question about goals. Or that was Daley. Daley's question, I'm sorry.
And that's...
That would be one of those goals discussions, so...
And that's on our high-level questions, too.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
You might want to take... this was prepared by... fund staff, so you might want to take a look at this again, sort of the high-level questions that we might want to pose. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be a good idea, when either staff or testifiers cite other sources or studies to support an argument for doing or not doing something, that we have that we're presented with the background of that source, a bio of that source, so that we can judge not only the data but the validity or the merit of it by looking at the source. So a description of their biography, and I'd like to know what their point of view is going into their studies.
Good point. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, is there any expertise in any of our institutions on pension issues that we might be able to look at, the Carlson School or something?
I would certainly think so.
Assume so. Isn't there somebody who would like to come give us a little?
Maybe we ought to do kind of a search of resources.
I guess General Mills. I don't know if Donna Peterson is still there or she's already left, but the people at the university always said that they wanted us to contact them whenever there was a subject that we wanted expertise on.
Yeah.
So.
Good question.
That one man that came to
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think all of these things, it's really, really valuable for all of us as pension members to be able to contribute to next month's agenda and to be able to have the time to do that. And I think all these points are really valid, whether it's General Mills or IBM or 3M or some of these bigger entities. But the other thing is that the frame of reference in the past has included a lot of DBs in both the private sector, public sector, and IRAs, 401ks, Roth IRAs are relatively new phenomenon over these last few years. And when we're looking at things, we're looking at projecting out to the next 30 years. And so I think it's really important that we look at things that the past has those flavor, just like Representative Smith said, that context. And then going forward, there's kind of a different context for the citizen. So I'm looking forward to them kind of saying on a contemporary basis kind of where is that going in the future as they see those trends continuing. Mm-hmm. The other thing that is... we have a 401k, we had the IRA Roths, and then they did a private sector 401k Roth type. But there's not a public sector 457 Roth that I know of. And if for next month, if we could have a update on the federal level to where that might be or could be or just a status on that. Because I think those sorts of things on a parity with the private sector has a Roth IRA, and there's a 401k Roth, then it seems like the public sector should have a parity at least in a similar program. But last I checked, it was not being acted on was a proposal, but maybe somebody can check into that if we could.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, did
yeah, Bergstrom.
With the Roth point, federal law was passed. We would be offering the Roth point. Is that the
discussion? How quick?
January 1, so I could, I'd be happy at the next meeting to talk about that.
Oh, good.
That's great. That's quick.
You know, you just bring it up. And
very easy.
I was told
we passed it just when you were sitting.
Glad I brought it up when you were here.
We've got good people. Other suggestions for next time?
Mr. Chair, I mentioned this yesterday. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mentioned this yesterday about looking at, if we are going to look at hybrid plans, look at what Georgia, Indiana, Michigan, Oregon, and Utah have done. If there's a way that we could obtain that information, low cost, no cost, to see what other states have done before we start investing money and time into Milliman doing a study, if there's some information out there we can sure. get that may be a good place to start.
Yeah. Representative
Cox? Mr. Chairman, just having been at a meeting that someone from NCSL was at, they remind us that we pay our dues and we get their expertise and they come to our states and so forth. So we might, again, we might have a conversation to see if there's someone who's an expert on that issue at NCSL or CSG.
Yeah. Let me suggest this. Let me run down the list of topics or that we've talked about that's been identified here so far. And maybe what we could or should do is to ask staff to take a closer look at those topics and who might be available to help us work through them or what approach they might suggest. And then we could get a survey out to all of you, hoping a quick turnaround as to which of these you think are the highest priority for October. We could save some of them could be for November as well. But here's the list I have. In addition to the issue of the interest earnings assumption of 8.5%, which we haven't resolved yet, also we need to take a look at the assumption on salaries and employee growth, whether those assumptions that are in statute are still valid assumptions for us. Suggestion that we look at the slate of goals for retirement, including questioning it was 85%. If that still is a good goal, looking at the possibility of a hybrid stacking hybrid alternative, and what maybe some other states have done along those lines. To get some more information about GASB rulings and what effect that might have on us as a state and local units of government. Taking a look at this cash balance alternative that Nebraska has been using. Look at what is happening in the private sector with regard to pensions, bringing in folks who've done studies or who are experts in that regard, and that includes searching for available resources, that university resources, private sector resources that might be available to talk with us. As Mr. Bergstrom talked about the Roth option for public sector and what they're working on with MSRS. Clearly, when it comes to resources, NCSL, we ought to use them. We're paying dues, and we ought to find out if somebody there is available to come and talk to us about what other states are doing. That's the list I have so far. Mr. Martin, is that complete? Or?
Mr. Chair, I think that's everything I have. Mine is a little more fragmented and unorganized. So you've done a job of putting it in a nice, neat list.
Is that a fair list at this point? What about my suggestion, then, if we'd ask Mr. Martin to sort of sketch out what each of these might look like or who we might call upon to help us with that, and then send that around to all of you and have you indicate which are the ones you'd like to address first now and at the next meeting in October. How does that sound?
Sounds good, Mr. Chair.
Way to proceed. Okay.
No.
I would like to get we're a little less than a month away, and I don't know how much time you might need to sketch some of this out and get it sent around, but I would hope that we would be able to set the agenda at least 2 weeks in advance, if not more, so that all of us know what that is. The public would also know. So is that doable?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll shoot for mid next week, getting a circulating document out to you folks.
Okay. Okay. Any other points of discussion for today? Again, I thank all of you for your attention and engagement and participation. I think we've had two very good days of discussion here, and I look forward to the next time we get together. So with that, we stand adjourned.